Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and PT pearls to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Okay, you guys have heard Dom talk about Willy California. Now, the thing about this brand, not only is it literally made in Los Angeles and a new company, but it fits men so well and it doesn't have big logos. And truly, this has been one of my favorite things to see Dom in. And with Valentine's Day just around the corner, treating your partner to something that he's going to look and feel his best in is absolutely incredible. So head to the link in the show notes and use code Dr. Dom 30. That's DRDOM 30. And that's right. They're offering 30% for our listeners only this Valentine's Day, which is such a huge and generous offer. And I will say, if you're purchasing for your partner and you don't want them to know, I usually stick a bit true to size in this kind of brand. And it is more of a slim tailored fit. So if you don't like it to be too tight, then maybe go up a size. Otherwise, true to fit. It looks amazing. It's going to fit them great and it's going to look so good.
So our next guest is going to be talking about one of Jen and my favorite things, which is the brain and neuroscience and how exercise specifically and the way we move impacts our brain and our long-term brain health. So Ryan Glad is a good friend of both of ours, and he has been a personal trainer and brain health coach with over a decade of experience in the health and fitness industry, everywhere from doing body work to personal training to stuff within kinesiology, but it has always kind of directed him back around to the brain. And he currently works alongside clinicians and researchers to study the effects of cognitively enhanced and comprehensive exercise plans at the Pacific Brain Health Center in Santa Monica, California. He actively consults with companies who leverage exercise for brain health and educates health and fitness professionals with the first course to comprehensively address exercise and the brain called the Brain Health Trainer Course. I've looked through this personally. It's a great way to understand as a fitness professional how to gear your clients' exercise a little bit more towards their needs. He's had over 1,000 people go through this thing already. He'll mention a little bit more about it throughout, but also just has so many amazing tips on how we can better understand how our exercise is impacting our brain. Listen in. All right, Ryan, so stoked to have you on today and talk the brain a bit. Can you just first open up and tell us what makes you passionate about doing what you do? It's kind of where we like to start with everyone.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. Big fan. Both of you, in fact.
I know.
So I am a health and fitness professional. I'm a personal trainer. I have my bachelor's in exercise science. I'm a health coach. I just finished my master's in applied neuroscience. And I used to be a body worker. So about 10 years ago, I started in the fitness industry. I grew up overweight. I had a concussion as a child. And the way I lost weight and actually rehabbed a lot of my brain's abilities, I struggle with school, socially, and my concussion was right on the front of my head, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, for anyone that's interested, and caused quite a bit of ADHD and cognitive symptoms. And so the way I actually rehabbed it and introduced wellness and exercise into my life was through a game called Dance Dance Revolution. And so I got the PlayStation 2 version in my home, or like middle school era, and played it like religiously, lost tons of weight. That actually motivated me to start going to the gym. There was a gym that opened across from my high school. Me and all my fat childhood friends made a pact, go to the gym, lose weight, continue to get fit. I went there, saw this very traditional personal trainer working out with people. He sort of like indirectly mentored me. I'm like, I want to be like that guy to a degree, right? And so through my own weight loss journey, I became a trainer to help other people achieve the same thing. Not too uncommon of a story for, you know, people in this profession. And the brain stuff I was always interested in. Before I knew I wanted to study kinesiology and be a trainer, I was actually very interested in animal science, animal behavior. I grew up watching Animal Planet like nobody's business. I'm like, I want to understand animals. So my community college had this animal, exotic animal training management program. It's kind of interesting. And so I would like take notes and watch water buffalo chew hay for like 3 hours. I'm like, cool, he was chewing hay for 3 hours. And then I actually didn't get into the program. It was a lottery system because it was a community college, so you don't get selected based on your grades or anything like that. So the rejection of my retrospectively foolish dream of like training animals for movies and TV, I was like inspired by Air Bud. And looking back, I'm like, that was I'm dodged a bullet there. That's kind of a weird profession and maybe not that ethical. So I fell into this kinesiology program at my community college, and I was mentored by a guy who was on the curriculum development team for like NASM way back in the day. Mm-hmm. And he started this community college program. So you take a class, and at the end of the class, you can take these certification tests, right? So I was in that program, went to get my bachelor's. At the time, my mom was going through, she had gestational diabetes after mm-hmm. she gave birth to me. That led to kidney disease. She had a leg amputation because of that, all these neuropathies. And so I saw her going through physical therapy with her prosthetics and stuff like that. And I was very inspired by the alliance, the therapeutic alliance mm-hmm. between her and the therapist and helping her walk and stuff like that. So it was very inspirational for me to see that. And I said, I think I want to go from, you know, general personal trainer. I was working at 24 Hour Fitness, you know, and I don't look like the personal trainer type. I didn't then. I don't now. I was like the skinniest, scrawniest kid in 24 Hour Fitness. My shirts were too big for me. And I quickly became like the nerdy corrective exercise guy and, you know, solving problems, very cerebral. Is before exercise, corrective exercise was cool, I assure you. And
You started the trend.
I started the trend, right? And so I started to get into that area. I worked for physical therapists as their, you know, PT aides and stuff. And so I, after seeing what my mom went through, I really wanted to become a PT more than anything. She passed away when I was a senior in high school, and I made a promise to her that I would become a PT in her legacy. Mm. So unfortunately, I suck at standardized tests. I took the GRE, did not go well. I got rejected from all these programs. You guys know how it is, how difficult it is to get into PT school. So I applied outside the country. I got into a school in Glasgow, Scotland. It's a different program. It's 2 years, and they do master's programs in physiotherapy instead of doctorate programs. I said, good enough. I don't know if I'm going to come back and carry that over. I was more short-term focused. I lived in West Africa for a year in like a kind of an unofficial clinical internship, if you will, working at a PT clinic there. From West Africa, went to Scotland. I had the wrong visa. I screwed up my visa, had a visitor's of a student. They put me in an immigration detention jail for 7 days.
Oh my God.
I got deported back to LA. And I'm like, what do I do now? So immediately enrolled in two programs. One is called the Gray Institute. You may have heard of it. And then Tom Myers, who wrote the book Anatomy Trains, I enrolled in his bodywork program to become a structural integrator, which is what Rolfers are. And so I finished that program. The laws in California required that I didn't need to be a massage therapist to practice. Practiced for about 2 years, burnt myself out, and got bored. I said, you know what? I am noticing that when I'm health coaching people and doing body work, trying to get people out of pain, doing corrective exercise, that they have these challenges. And these challenges are things like emotional regulation, adhering to the programs I would give them, remembering what we worked on, things that cognitively got in the way of them reaching their goals. I started to reach back into my animal behavior studies and kind of dive back into being interested in neuroscience. And I was interested along the whole way, you know. As I'm going through body work, I'm thinking about, like, well, what's the brain equivalent of this, right? And all these people saying trauma is stored in the tissue. I'm like, I've done dissections. I haven't found it. What's going on in the brain? And of course, this pain science stuff started to emerge, as you know.
Yeah.
So I was interested in the brain the whole time. And it wasn't until I got upset by statements like trauma is stored in the body. Of course, brain, body are connected and body cognition. We don't have to dive into that. I agree, but I'm, you know, the mechanisms in which it's described, I disagree with. And so that stuff got me into neuroscience. So I got into neuroscience again because I was pissed and I was bored. It was a negative emotion that fueled me. But I also was driven to help my clients and the people I was working with to achieve their goals. And I saw that these cognitive, let's call them inefficiencies, I don't want to call them impairments, these cognitive inefficiencies were stopping them from reaching success. And so I wanted to see within my toolbox as a health coach, personal trainer, body worker, what could I do to facilitate that more directly and more explicitly. Mm-hmm. So I started to research, well, what are the interventions that can make a significant impact on the brain? Of course, there's a lot of things: mindfulness, nutrition, sleep, so on, you know, getting out of pain, All these things are great for the brain and can help with brain health over the long term and in the short term. And so I started to think, well, what's the most powerful tool that most people aren't really utilizing for brain health? And it turned out to be exercise. So I started to dive into the literature on exercise in the brain, which we can talk about in detail, and start to understand how exercise affects the brain. I said, okay, if exercise is good for the brain, and I just tell people to exercise, generally speaking, that's cool, and I'm promoting exercise for brain health, and that's going to be helpful, but how can I be specific with people? Is there some type of exercise prescription, changing the type of exercise, the frequency, the intensity, duration, all these acute variables like we would do for what's called exercise prescription to reach a goal like hypertrophy or weight loss or mobility, but do it for brain health? Understanding that there's very specific brain health outcomes. Are we changing the size of your brain, the function of your brain? Are we trying to improve a mental health condition or prevent something like dementia or manage something like depression? Or are we trying to improve certain aspects of cognition, which are mental functions such as attention, memory, reaction time? And so I wanted to get more, take a precision medicine approach to exercise prescription for brain health. And so that's the road I've been following. And that was probably 4 years ago. I started thinking that way. And I saw that a lot of people were taking this functional medicine and precision medicine approach for nutrition, but everybody was being very general when it came to exercise. All this long list of stuff to do for nutrition based on your blood labs and your genetics. And we know how that is. And that's great. And then people saying, oh, just do HIIT. Just do high intensity interval training.
3x10.
And so, yeah, exactly. And so there's this lack of knowledge and expertise and application. The research is there and we'll review it. I mean, different types of exercise do different things. And the level of evidence for those recommendations is varied, but it's there. And no one was doing anything about it. And so as I started to apply this knowledge to my practice, I started to find that I was helping people achieve goals that were more meaningful to them. The 55-year-old CEO that wanted to work as long as he could because that's how he really found purpose in his life. Or the 80-year-old client who wanted to get out of pain, but not just wanted to play with her grandkids and remain functional, but wanted to prevent dementia to remember her grandkids' names. So these goals that were so deeply impactful that I could now help them achieve. And that was more meaningful to me as a health and fitness professional. It's not just that I'm getting them out of pain, it's that I'm helping them maintain what is an organ that contributes to identity and activities of daily living and the ability to interact with the world, their inner world, their external world, and interact with the ones they love and people around them. That's so impactful, right? And so I look at that and I'm like, what have we been doing as an industry? Why are we not helping solve this huge problem of exponentially increasing rates of dementia and mental health issues? Of course, the in which many aspects of the body are related, things like obesity and pain all are related. I'm not saying they're separate, but how can we address that more explicitly and directly? Where is the dementia prevention program? Where is the depression prevention or depression treatment program utilizing exercise? And go beyond the generality of it's good for you and go to the specificity of this is what you as an individual right now in your life should be doing. So that's what I'm interested in doing. And I sort of paved this way for myself as a health and fitness professional to apply that knowledge. And so if people have, I can do this just by interviewing someone and seeing, well, what are you struggling with cognitively or mentally? What are your goals? What are you doing now? Okay, let's tweak this and that. And this is based on this evidence or whatnot. But now with cognitive testing, with neuroimaging, you can get a brain scan. And with the assistance of doctors and medical professionals, we can look at your brain and say, this is the exercise you should be doing because this area of the brain is asking for that. You're doing a lot of resistance training. You're doing a lot of aerobic. That looks great. But your cerebellum, this part of your brain responsible for motor learning in the back of your brain, that's you're having some atrophy there. It's shrinking. And maybe that's why you're experiencing the symptoms you're experiencing. Why don't we do more coordinative exercise like dance, martial arts, or ping pong, right? So that level of exercise prescription, it's not only cool, it's gratifying as heck. And most of the time, I'm working with older adults where these complaints and concerns are more explicit. They're more in the forefront of their minds, people 50 plus, if you will. But even for people like our age, we're interested in improving our brains as well as preventing dementia. And we might look at our parents or we might look at our grandparents and where those issues are more explicit. We know we don't want that if it is there. And everyone's brains change normally across the lifespan. How do we slow that process down, like just like we do for physical aging, right? How can we optimize or slow down that curve of cognitive aging, if you will? And how can we optimize our brains in the short term for career success, for, you know, improving the quality of life, for improving how we feel mentally? And also, how do we recover from things like concussion, which I know, I don't know if you've had,
Jen. No, but Dom, for sure.
Dom has, I have. How do we, you know, relate things like hormonal health to our brain health, for instance? So how can we, you know, improve our sleep as it relates to our exercise, or how can we change our exercise program to facilitate sleep so that we're adding on to the amount that our brain health improves, if you will? So there's all sorts of ways to look at this. And so I love educating health professionals on how to do this in their own practice. So I have a course that teaches health and fitness professionals how to do this, understanding the science of the brain at a basic level, understanding what exercise does to the brain, and how to tweak all these variables to facilitate different goals. But I also love helping what I'll call the general population understand this and apply it for themselves, sort of self-modify or self-prescribe exercise programs based on what their goals are, but also checking off all the boxes. What are these characteristics that should be in my brain, my exercise program, if my goal was brain health and mental health for that matter?
Well, I love where you approach this as well, because it's not just like, oh, here's the pain, we're just going to attack the pain. And I think it's so easy to get so focused on that because it's something that's so present within someone's experience. This is what I'm experiencing right now. So even though my goal might be, you know, picking up my children and not feeling pain and doing all the other stuff, what gets focused on prior to that is the pain. Just make it go away, you know, and you find whatever little minute thing that you can find, or some fancy tool that is just going to help it relieve, right? And we don't focus on that end goal of what is the goal beyond that pain? Why is the reason why it means so much to you to relieve this pain? And I think that's such a beautiful way to draw people back to that further focus.
Like, it's a long-term
goal. What is the
goal
beyond just relieving pain? Why? What would that provide you in your life? And I hope that people just start to, you know, kind of hear that. And as we talk through different prescriptions of what people can do based on where they're at or what they want to achieve, like always focusing on that. I think that's such a beautiful point to like really hone in and bring back for people.
I appreciate that. And it comes down to maintaining functional independence. And people in pain feel they can't function like they did before. They're less independent, or at least they're scared of that potentially. And I won't go into pain neuroscience because it's a separate topic, but there is a relationship between cognitive functioning, how, you know, emotional regulation, planning, organizing, paying attention, short-term memory, and pain. And so pain can affect that. We should resolve that pain so that you can function better and, you know, mentally and physically, and get rid of it. But I think at the end of the day, regardless of your age, regardless of your career path, regardless of your health goals, we have these short-term goals like mobility, pain, weight loss, muscle gain. Typically, they're aesthetic, typically. Just looking at statistically what the goals are for people and what people want. And that's great. And there are relationships between, you know, reducing the amount of body fat and, you know, improving the neuroinflammatory biomarkers in your brain. And that leads to brain health. It all leads to the same, you know, similar goals. But in the long term, I think we're all interested in maintaining our functional independence and our identity and the ability to do what we want. And cognition, once again, are these mental functions that allow us to do things and interact with the world outside of us and inside of us. That's kind of important, right? And so we should let's make an intentional plan to maintain those functions and even improve them.
So I want to talk a little bit into, because you talked about how you have had to overcome and work on how you prescribe yourself exercise for some of the symptoms of concussion you may have had, or
my ADHD, for instance.
Totally. Or that we can, you know, tool and prescribe our exercise differently. Can you give us a few examples maybe of like something you've done and what specifically you're trying to target in your own behavior or your own neurology with that exercise? And maybe another example that you might prescribe somebody who's older who might be dealing with dementia.
That's a great point. So let's start at a bit of a higher level. What kinds of characteristics need to be in an exercise program if generalized brain health was the goal? We're talking mental health, generalized brain health for, you know, improved cognition, slowing down the atrophy or the shrinking of the brain that can occur with age or neurodegenerative diseases. There's three primary what I call macronutrients that should be in an exercise plan. They're not nutrients literally, but everyone understands carbs, fats, and proteins, right? So the metaphor I give is there's three macronutrients, air quotes, for exercise and brain health. There's aerobic exercise, not surprising. There's resistance training or strength training. They're sort of interchangeable, but talking about external load, and we'll talk about why. And there's this concept that there's this third category that a lot of people don't talk about. It's called neuromotor training. And if you look at the physical activity guidelines for second Americans, which was released by ACSM, American College of Sports Medicine, alongside with, you know, all these experts and researchers and collaborators to decide on what Americans should be doing for all these health-related outcomes. You've probably heard this before. 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous aerobic exercise per week. You've heard that before, right? Yeah. That comes from these physical activity guidelines for Americans, the second edition. So that's true. Research shows that adhering, or at least getting to, at the minimum, 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous aerobic exercise per week is helpful for brain health. They've added brain health benefits to those recommendations, and people should seek to achieve that if they're not there already. So most people are sedentary, or most people don't exercise that much. And 150 minutes is a weird number, but it could be five times a week for 30 minutes per session. It could be three times per week for approximately 60 minutes per session. But just getting there, that's the first step to achieving better brain health. If you're not there, get there. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about a lot of specific stuff, and sometimes people will hear that as the ideal and then feel bad or guilty or a failure that they're not reaching the ideal. But our lives ebb and flow behaviorally, environmentally.
It's kind of like talking about diets when most people are eating a crap ton of sugar and processed stuff. And it's like, okay, let's
just reduce that.
Reduce that a little bit first.
Stop trying to achieve like ketosis or like these perfect ratios. Exactly. Just reduce that first. So we have to consider behavioral economics whenever we talk about any of this. So reaching that is going to be helpful for a variety of reasons. And we'll talk about the mechanisms of how exercise impacts the brain. But the aerobic exercise is most researched, or at least most publicized, when we talk about brain health, mostly because of like the aerobics revolution the past 30 years. And but it's not the only thing that you can do for brain health, or it's not the best form of exercise for brain health. A lot of people say that, but I think they're neglecting the literature that's out there. Resistance training has increased in its adoption and popularity over the past 10 years, which is amazing because there's different things that happen with resistance training. For example, the contraction of skeletal muscle releases all these hormones, chemicals, and growth factors that go through the bloodstream, cross the brain, and say, hey, grow, be better, do good. And so, but they're different growth. Some are shared in different growth factors than that of aerobic exercise. So both of those are important in things like muscle mass, muscle strength, body fat, all that's been correlated to brain health. So it's important to maintain good muscle mass and good strength over the lifespan. You could imagine this for older adults, not being able to stand up from a chair easily. That the ability to sit to stand or walk quickly, as measured by tests like the sit to stand test or the timed up and go, those have been correlated to cognitive decline very directly. Even leg strength has been correlated to brain function. So it's really important to maintain strength across the entire lifespan. The last one is this neuromotor category. And we never hear about this because neuromotor doesn't usually subserve aesthetic goals. We usually talk about like metabolic stimulus from aerobic or resistance training. That's it. But neuromotor training is in those guidelines. Like I said, no one talks about it, but it has a particular relevance to brain health. And that is, when we do aerobic exercise and resistance training, we are using our brains to pay attention and follow instructions and memorize movements. But neuromotor training includes things like cardiovascular modalities that are more cognitively demanding, such as sports, dance, martial arts, but it also includes mind-body exercise like yoga, tai chi, qigong, things of that regard. Even mobility, I would consider to have mind-body exercise components, even though it's not as researched as an established modality like yoga. So with that said, you have to check off all three boxes. Are you doing aerobic exercise? If so, good. Are you doing resistance training? If so, good. Do you have a form of neuromotor exercise? Synonyms for neuromotor, because it's a weird name, include skill-based exercise where you're learning a skill, motor exercise, or coordination exercises, right? So those are all synonyms for that category. I think a lot of people find, oh, I am playing tennis. Oh, I do dance and I really enjoy it. Like, this modality really changes people's lives. I was talking to someone who's, she's getting her PhD and she's been really overwhelmed and struggling cognitively to maintain her family and be in school. And I checked in with her the other day And I said, how are things going? She said, I'm doing great. I'm like, why? Like, why are you doing great? She said, well, cognitively, I'm better. Psychologically, I'm better. I started doing kickboxing twice a week.
Mm.
She was doing all this other stuff. She was even doing yoga tune-up, Jill Miller stuff, mm-hmm. right? So she had mind-body, she had aerobic, she had resistance, and then she adopted kickboxing, which is a neuromotor category.
Mm-hmm.
And so you hear people have this really emotional, valuable relationship with things like dance or boxing or Tai Chi or yoga. So this neuromotor category is really valuable. We just never identify it as such. So whereas aerobic exercise and resistance training, both of those things release all these growth factors and blood flow and neurochemicals and hormones that cross the blood-brain barrier. And the brain is getting better functionally and structurally as a result of that. But that perspective puts the brain at this like passive receiver of these beneficial things from the body. But neuromotor exercise, you have to pay attention. You use your cognitive functions directly.
Yeah.
You have to be cognitively engaged. Otherwise, you're not going to follow along. Otherwise, you will get hit with that ball. Otherwise, you will get punched in the face. And so those types of things are really valuable for directly engaging your brain. So you've heard of brain games.
Mm-hmm.
This is brain and body together. It's the simultaneous recruitment of cognitive functions and motor functions. And there's a recent systematic review that came out, which is a very respectable form of research versus just a small single study, that showed, at least for younger adults, because most of the research and the stuff I'm talking about is in older adults, because that's where most of the funding is, that's where the problems are. You know, cognitively, at, you know, around 25, 30, we peak in our cognitive abilities. So we're not worried about it as much as an 80-year-old might be.
Yeah.
But there's a systematic review that just came out showing that for younger adults, younger, healthier adults, coordinative exercise improves cognitive abilities more than other types of exercise. So it's interesting. If we want to improve our cognition, challenge your brain by engaging in these cognitively demanding modalities. Now, how much, how often, how novel should it be? We can get into all that. But just to take a step back, those three things, aerobic, resistance, neuromotor, if you're having all three of those things in your program, regardless of frequency, intensity, duration, that's better than just doing one form. So that's probably, you know, I'm a good teacher because I'm like such a failure in my own health. If you look at me, I am not the pinnacle of health, right? But I feel that qualifies me more than other people. Like, I feel like some influencers and people are like, look at me, you will never get this. You know, it's like the Borat, you will never get this. You will never get this. That was, of course, a different context, but you get what I'm saying. So you look at me, you're like, who's that chubby 29-year-old? He's not the pinnacle of health. So I'm always struggling to answer your question, Dom. I'm always trying to get back to checking those things off. So personally, I could do more vigorous resistance training. Mm. I could do more vigorous aerobic exercise. I do the neuromotor stuff through things like virtual reality, extra gaming, which sounds or way out there.
Paddle hacky sack.
Paddle hacky sack, the stuff we were playing. So it's with my ADHD brain, I love novel experiences. So that draws me towards neuromotor exercise. Now, I do aerobic, I do resistance, but you heard me say I could do more intensity. So mm-hmm. I could modulate the acute variable of intensity in my program.
Like do it on expert on DDR instead right. of on easy. Because I heard you talking about DDR a little
bit. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. So in the neuromotor category, I get real sweaty with the stuff I do. It's when I do that like pure aerobic HIIT training or that resistance training that I'm like distracted during my sets. I'm texting, I'm on Instagram. I consider myself busy or I don't take as much time as I should. So my workouts are 20 minutes where I might benefit from longer duration exercise mm-hmm. modalities. So that's, you know, even though I'm checking it off, now I have to manipulate the variables yeah. for my improved brain health. And a nice way to look at this is do what you're not doing.
Yeah.
If you're not doing aerobic, do aerobic.
Yeah.
If you're not doing neuromotor, do neuromotor. If you're stressed out and you're doing all three, do more mind-body exercise instead of boxing and HIIT training and get that, you know, that sympathetic nervous system regulated a little bit more. Manage your stress a little bit more. So there's all these ways to look at it, but a very simple way to do it is take this structured variability approach to your exercise program. I'm not doing high intensity, so I should do more of that. I'm doing too much high intensity, let me do low and moderate. So that's an example of how I might go about tweaking these programs.
And do you see that as good carryover? If I start this now, say mm-hmm. I'm in my 30s and I want to improve my brain health into the future, if I just kind of focus on these three areas mm-hmm. and what am I neglecting? What can I put in more?
Mm-hmm.
What is like the statistic, you know, benefit, say, later on in age?
Yeah. So there's more and more research coming out showing that risk and symptoms of dementia very early on, you may not feel them, but maybe, you know, at a small level, your brain is changing across the lifespan. Those things show up 20 to 30 years before any cognitive impairment or incidence of dementia or symptoms that may appear. So we do know that these types, your brain, what you do now impacts it later. Mm-hmm. This is true for concussion, you know, PTSD, adverse childhood experiences, having poor health in middle adulthood, that shows up later. And so if you are, you know, 20s to 30s, 35, early 40s, like start now. Don't wait till you have a problem.
Yeah.
Start now. And that's true for all aspects of health and wellness, not just exercise, but sleep, nutrition, stress management, all these other things that contribute to this concept called cognitive reserve, which is like your brain's gas tank over the lifespan. So the more positive things you put into your life, it improves or boosts theoretically cognitive reserve, which is like, it's like this aging curve. So you're changing the point at where you are in the sort of the x-axis, how high that is. But also, instead of having a steeper trajectory of decline, you extend it. It's a less of a steep slope of decline. If you have something like a concussion, it bumps you down. If you have all these negative lifestyle factors, it bumps you down. So you can boost it by adhering to these things. I'm not aware of too many studies where these people adhere to, you know, these 30-year-olds adhere to this multimodal exercise program. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, that requires a longitudinal study.
Yeah.
And you know, but we do know that people who exercise more generally and adhere to greater levels of physical activity do prevent this. Some statistics say by 30 to 40%, some say by 5%, some say by 10 years, some say by 5 years, but it helps.
Exactly.
We can't give the exact statistic because it depends
on
your age. We know gender plays a role here, all sorts of things, socioeconomics, where you are in the world, ethnicity, but we know it helps across the board. So the longitudinal studies are a bit more general. They're not as specific, but my theory, and I piece this theory together with different levels of evidence, is that this multimodal exercise program is going to be more beneficial than just aerobic exercise alone.
Yeah.
Now, if you're not doing anything, just walking will be better than nothing. And then above that, more aerobic exercise will be better than nothing. And then aerobic and resistance exercise will be better than nothing. And then aerobic resistance and motor will be better than nothing. Although there is some something called the Copenhagen City Heart Study that did a longitudinal study on tens of thousands of people and found that people who played things like racket sports lived longer than those who went just to the gym. And that could be because of the social, in the narrative review and the discussion piece of that paper, they say it could be because of the social contact, the social support, which is extremely important. I think through quarantine, we found, even though we're not older adults, we have found that loneliness and isolation takes a huge toll on our mental and brain health. You may notice that your verbal fluency isn't as good, that you're more prone to things like depressive or anxiety symptoms. Like, that is very real.
Yeah.
So social support is a huge aspect of this. I think a bonus to these neuromotor categories, dance, boxing, tennis, is that they're usually inherently pretty social, right? Versus just doing HIIT training on your own in the home. Another theory I have is that the reason people might live longer because of playing racket sports is the cognitive demand that is involved in those sports. More research is needed, as is the statement at the end of every research study, known to man. But I hope that answers your question about like longevity and how it contributes.
Totally.
So anything's better than nothing. More is better than little.
Yeah.
And then incorporating, there's some evidence to show that these neuromotor categories, it's not to say don't go to the gym because of that study, but incorporate it. These rackets, it doesn't have to be racket sports. I think rackets, you may not like racket sports. You may not have access. Maybe it's only, you know, the rich people that get the tennis courts. Yeah. But something that is in the neuromotor category that you enjoy. For example, how universal is dance?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. We could talk about socioeconomics and how some people may not be able to access the gym or tennis courts, but how universal is something like dance, right?
Yeah.
So that's great to acknowledge. And I think people may do it already, but recognizing why they do it might make it more impactful and maybe increase the adherence, or maybe they do it more because of hearing something like that.
Yeah, I like that.
It's kind of like, it's a real challenge though, because within what you're talking about, like you said yourself at the beginning, the biggest challenge most people face is like this cognitive inefficiency or this
behavioral change.
So like, how again can we tell people to focus on behavior change when it is the behaviors that are so challenging themselves? So that's where, like, someone sitting at home, we can start to explore different movement things, and maybe you'll find one you enjoy. Yeah. Like, how can somebody go about starting to do that?
Because
when you're in that place, it's really, really hard to make the changes.
So I think this is the value of health coaching and why health and wellness professionals should have an expertise in behavior change or health coaching. And this is what I do at my job at the Pacific Brain Health Center.
It's, by the way, I love that you say that, because since I started in PT school, everyone has always asked what my specialty was going to be.
And you say behavior
from
change.
From the very beginning, I've said behavior change, because I realized that my ability to teach people in that is my success in any other specific area.
It doesn't matter what it is. Yeah. The behavior, whether it serves the physical and or the mental realms, it is behavior change. Yep. Well, and that's what I was talking, that's what I saw in my bodywork clients. I was like,
totally.
I have an issue changing behavior. So at my job at the Pacific Brain Health Center, I'm usually working with older adults to change behavior. So, and let me just say, it's the old dog, new tricks thing. That's ageist. I'm not ageist, but it can be challenging to coach older adults.
After
right?
you coach it's Midwestern 80-year-old farmers, like, trust me, man, I know exactly what you're talking
about.
So
I get like the fishermen and like, and so, but it's, I love the challenge because it really puts your behavior change skills to the test.
Mm. Yeah.
So it depends on where they're at. I'd love to speak generally, but we have to individualize. So if the person's not moving at all, we have to inch towards that 150 minutes. If I just get them to walk once a week and that's more than they're doing, awesome. But the master plan is to get them to adhere to it. But I think one of the biggest things is identifying preferences, identifying activities they enjoy, and having them self-select.
Yeah.
So I have an example of this guy who is kind of like the persona you described, Dom, where it's like, he's heavy into construction. He's a man's man. You can't tell him what to do. And he's like, I do stuff all the time. I'm carrying my ladder. I'm knocking down walls. I don't need to exercise. Right?
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, that's physical activity, but that's not exercise. You do have these metabolic risk factors. You do have cognitive impairment early on, a subjective cognitive decline. We need to do more. So he was closed to the resistance training. He was closed to the structured aerobic training. I said, what have you enjoyed? He's like, well, I used to enjoy paddle tennis or pickleball, and I haven't done it anymore. I said, why? He's like, oh, I have this issue with hand arthritis. Mm. I'm like, oh, well, let's solve that. Let's get you to a hand therapist or a PT, and let's get you back to doing that. If you did that, how often would you do it? He's like, I could do it twice a week. I'm like, okay, for how long? Oh, 60 minutes. I'm like, great. We went from zero to theoretically 120 minutes of, and it is metabolically demanding, of aerobic exercise. And that would be the gateway behavior, instead of a gateway drug, a gateway behavior to other things.
Yeah.
Right? And or I could leverage the fact that he's experiencing a pain point of cognition, of cognitive impairment, and educate him on the fact that resistance training and aerobic training play a role. So yes, you have this strong aversion or this strong preference, but is the pain point so great that we can negotiate or agree that you should be doing this, right? So of course, this individual is now adhering to the type of program I'm talking about, even though originally it was very difficult. So you got to inch towards it, and you can't just say, I'm doing it or I'm not. But I think giving people this baseline of understanding so they don't think that walking is the only thing they can do, or it's they're walking and thinking that structured exercise. Mm. Walking has been correlated to brain health, right? But you want to get them towards at least that 150 minutes and then try to encourage this modality-based variability. Now, when it comes to behavior change, you use your brain to change behavior. So if you put your hand on your forehead, right behind your hand is what's called your prefrontal cortex. Your prefrontal cortex houses something called executive functions. It's literally the CEO of your brain. Planning, organizing, short-term memory, controlling your impulses to eat that cookie or not to eat that cookie.
This is kind of the area that you and I have both had some of our concussion issues.
And so executive functions and concussion or not, and individuals who are finding it challenging to change their behavior are experiencing challenges with goal-oriented executive functioning. The goal might be to lose weight. Mm-hmm. The goal might be to adhere to this behavior. So they need help organizing. They need help planning. They need help controlling their inhibitions. That's where a health and fitness professional and or a health coach or the commonality behavior change or even a doctor comes into play, where changing behavior, they're literally outsourcing their executive functions to you. You're helping them plan and organize and discuss and get out of that emotional side of their brain to help them achieve their goal. So executive functions allow for goal-oriented achievement. Now, there's an interesting study that I came across last week that found that older women with smaller prefrontal cortex volumes had more trouble adhering to exercise. So is that a willpower conversation or is that a neurobiology conversation? So when we talk about ADHD or autism spectrum disorder, we talk about neurodiversity. Without any neurological condition or developmental issue, we have to consider neurodiversity for everybody. Everybody's brains are unique. And the process of coaching, health coaching specifically, but coaching in general, has been described as the process, I'll break this down, but the process of facilitated, self-directed neuroplasticity. There's that word, right? Mm-hmm. Neuroplasticity. So facilitated means I'm helping you do it. Basically what that means is I'm helping you change your own brain. Facilitating, I'm facilitating it. Self-directed, that's you. Neuroplasticity, changing your brain. So that's why coaching is important. It's the process of facilitated, self-directed neuroplasticity. So I hope that answers your question about like behavior change. It's a very important concept that when informed by neuroscience can be more effective.
But that's why I think you can see then in different socioeconomic communities, right? Because yes, the content is everywhere. And that's why people can say it's on YouTube. You can look on YouTube. You can look on anything. There's free resources to work out and to do all these things. But if you need to be guided by a coach, it is so hard to just expect people to do it.
Right. And so when people don't sleep well, when they are stressed, when they are sedentary, when they are not eating as well, it affects their executive functions.
Yeah.
So how can we just say, basically by telling someone to do something is it's elite. It's like health elitism.
Yes.
It's saying, it's easy for me. I'm doing it. So you have to do it. Mm-hmm. Use your willpower.
Yep.
No. Help guide this person. But everyone needs different guidance. Some people are more impulsive and then they get discouraged and fall off their goal because they can't control their impulses. Well, help them modify their environment. Help them use mindfulness techniques. There's all sorts of strategies. Maybe it's the planning that's catching people. Maybe it's the organizing. Maybe it's the time management. Maybe it's the emotional regulation. Maybe it's a combination of those. So indirectly assessing that, because we can't diagnose these things, but assessing that, I mean, there is something called an executive functioning questionnaire that I use with people, and it helps them figure out, okay, impulse control behaviorally and at least subjectively is a problem for you. Let's collaboratively work on strategies to help you problem solve that.
Yeah.
So this very logical procedural process is coaching. That's all it is. And so good coaches like you guys do it inherently. When you understand and empathize that an individual is an individual, you do this stuff. You just don't give it the names of these cognitive subdomains and break it down in the way I just described it. But good coaches do this. Now, these boosts in willpower, they can help, but how sustainable are they?
Yeah.
And that's where we need to understand an individual's brain.
Well, we need to understand how to give them the ability to access that willpower because it's something that they practice regularly. And you brought up this kind of Pandora's box of neuroplasticity.
Yes.
And I think that all the things that you're talking about play into this larger concept of neuroplasticity and how well our brain can change, how easily it can change, how much we've been acting in a certain way in our life or spending a certain time in a certain environment, and how readily available new environments or activities are to us can all play into our ability to be neuroplastic. So can you talk a little bit more into that?
Absolutely. So just like our bodies are able to change and shape and function, so are our brains. Our brain is an organ. It's a part of our body. Therefore, it maintains similar characteristics and plasticity. So I'd say, I don't know if this is a real term, but the ability for our muscles and our joints to change, that's bioplasticity. Well, when we talk about the brain, it's part of the nervous system. So we call that neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity is sort of misunderstood, but it's best understood as your brain's ability to change. So when people say they're targeting neuroplasticity, that's not valid. It's basically neuroplasticity is the mechanism by which you're able to make changes. And there's different kinds. There's functional neuroplasticity and structural neuroplasticity. And this is a helpful question because we can break down how exercise affects the brain at different levels. Usually when people talk about neuroplasticity, they're talking about it at the micro level. The micro level is if you imagine the brain and you zoom in microscopically, you're going to see a neuron, which is the most basic working unit. It's a brain cell. Just like you have cells in your tissues, you have cells in your brain. A neuron is a brain cell. So this neuron has different branch-like projections and they connect to other neurons and they connect to other neurons. It creates this network, just like fascia has a network, just like muscles are a network. We have a network in our brain. These are neuronal networks at the micro level, and they talk to each other and they send electrical signals And these electrical signals are usually determined by neurotransmitters. They're chemical messengers. And so the strength of those signals, the frequency of those signals, the duration of those signals, the distribution of those signals, that's function, that's brain electricity, that's brain blood flow, it's brain activity, brain metabolism. We're all talking about the same thing here. When that changes, that's functional neuroplasticity. So if I have brain cell A and brain cell B, I start firing a signal, and the receptivity of that signal or the strength of that signal, the frequency of that signal becomes more regular, then I'm going to have a functional change. Now, that functional change precedes a structural change. So when neurons connect more neurons, or the synapse, the connection between them gets bigger or stronger or more plentiful through processes like neurogenesis, the creation of new neurons, or synaptogenesis, the creation of the new synapses, these new bridges, that's structural neuroplasticity. Then we're going to zoom out. So that's the micro level. The macro level is when we look at the brain as a whole organ. So if I see changes in brain size, whether it's a brain growing smaller or bigger, that's structural neuroplasticity, but we saw how it started with function. Mm-hmm. Then it led to structure at the micro level. And also before structure at the macro level, we also have function because the brain's an electrical organ. So the prefrontal cortex talks to the cerebellum and talks to the parietal lobes and talks to the temporal lobes. It's these networks that are sending these informational highways back and forth. And so the brain's an electrical organ once again, and these functional networks can change. So when you are working and then you go for a long walk, you're changing the brain network functional connectivity, and you're experimenting with your brain's functional connections. That's also functional neuroplasticity. So just like in the body, where we need to have functional changes, these neurological changes happen first, the way the muscle cells work with each other change, then we have hypertrophy. Then it's, and so when people say neuroplasticity, they imagine new brain cells in the brain growing, and yeah, it's just a misunderstanding.
Structural
or
changes.
they use exactly, and that does happen, but it takes a while. So yeah. Functional changes at the micro level can occur in milliseconds, but actual larger brain changes can take months, years. And so that's why brain health as a long-term health goal is so valuable, in my opinion, because it requires time.
Totally.
It requires time. And I think this is true for other health goals.
Yep.
Now, when it comes to people saying things like neurons that wire together, fire together, that's based off a concept called Hebbian plasticity. This is also misunderstood. If I start brushing my teeth while I skateboard, I don't have a skateboard neuron and a toothbrush neuron that wire together. That's not true, right? So some of these things like neurons that wire together, fire together, and neuroplasticity, these statements, just as a cautionary statement, are used to sell people on things because not many people investigate neuroscience before investing in a product or service or modality of therapy. Yes, they exist, but we have to be cautious in the way we understand them.
It's just interesting, even when you say that, I try to think through, how does that make sense when the neurons fire together, wire together? Like if I did brush my teeth for years and years while I was skateboarding, would different motor networks develop that would allow me to do that easier?
Yes.
Probably.
Yes,
yeah. But I don't have a skateboard and a toothbrush neuron that suddenly become married in my head.
Now, there are, you know, neurons that there's one called a Jennifer Aniston neuron because neuroscientists have found that when they show a picture of Jennifer Aniston, there's a neuron that lights up.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And so they call it the Jennifer Aniston. So there are neurons and networks that represent certain things. But sometimes people, once again, use neuroplasticity and neurons that wire together, fire together to sell or to justify something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's more complicated than that.
Yeah.
So that's the micro level. When it comes to exercise, exercise is amazing because it facilitates this process of neurogenesis, the creation to create new brain cells, synaptogenesis, the process of creating new synapses, and also angiogenesis. Angio is Latin for blood, the cardiovascular system. And so when you are exercising, you typically increase your heart rate. That increases blood flow. Your brain has a vascular network in addition to an electrical network, and they're connected. So you can actually create new blood vessels in your brain, improving the delivery of oxygen and nutrients through exercise. So that's all at the micro level. In addition, you can improve the efficiency of neurotransmitters. You can improve the balance of them, the relationship between different neurotransmitters. There's excitatory neurotransmitters such as dopamine. There's inhibitory neurotransmitters such as serotonin. And exercise can help improve the balance of those in individuals with Parkinson's disease where they have less available dopamine. It can improve dopamine receptor sensitivity. So there's all these things it does at that micro level. At the macro level, exercise has been found to increase total brain volume, gray matter, white matter, two different types of tissue in the brain, gray matter is neurons that are unmyelinated. Myelinated is like if we take a cord and we look at the wrapping around that cord, that's the myelin. The cord on the electrical, you know, wire on the inside is the neuron. In white matter, the neurons are just myelinated with this oligodendrocytes or fat-based wrapping. And so white matter and gray matter both improve in structure and function as a result of exercise. That's at the macro level. We see areas like in the brain called the hippocampus, an area of the brain responsible for learning and memory and emotion, grow in response to exercise. We see areas like the prefrontal cortex grow in response to exercise, the cerebellum. And yes, there's some studies showing that different types of exercise do different things to different regions. And then, of course, that neuromotor category, that's going to mostly target that functional neuroplasticity because we're using our prefrontal cortex, those same executive functions, to organize and interact in response to a goal, whether it's a dance move or a tennis ball. And we're using those cognitive functions more directly instead of just doing aerobic exercise, kind of spacing out or watching TV.
Yeah.
Which isn't bad because we're producing those growth factors at the micro level that are produced by the cardiovascular system, the pulmonary system, the muscular system. And it releases things like BDNF or brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which you've probably all heard about. But and that's great because that's been called Miracle-Gro for the brain. It's one of those proteins and molecules that crosses the blood-brain barrier and says, dude, grow faster, stay healthy. Mm-hmm. The problem is people say BDNF and then stop there when it's much more complex. So when we are engaging in neuromotor exercise, for instance, we're not targeting so much of the structural neuroplasticity, but more the functional neuroplasticity, that synaptic modification of skill development. And so that's why it's important to have all three, because they do different things. So aerobic exercise might release VEGF or vascular endothelial growth factor, which encourages more blood vessels. The BDNF we just identified. Another one called insulin-like growth factors. These are called growth factors or myokines that are released from muscle that are basically hormones that tell the brain to do good things. Now, resistance training and aerobic training release different profiles of these growth factors. That's why variability is important. It's like having a variety of things in your diet, right? So that's why I call them the macronutrients for exercise and brain health, because it's similar to diet in some ways. You want a variety. You want multiple growth factors. So there's another one called irisin, which is, iris in Greek mythology is like messenger to the gods. So irisin is released from muscular contraction, usually as the result of resistance training, and crosses the blood-brain barrier, once again telling the brain to grow. But it's not as much of that is released in aerobic exercise. So we have these different profiles, these neuroendocrine profiles from these different modalities, whereas neuromotor exercise will release those growth factors, but it once again is responsible for that functional engagement of the brain, that functional neuroplasticity. And so if we want to get as many of these growth factors, as many of these functional, structural, micro, macro benefits as possible, that's why I said do those three things. So I was just starting with the summary of the takeaway there. Because I think that's what people ask. So it's like, well, how do I apply this stuff?
Yeah.
And in addition, you know, different intensities might yield different effects on these mechanisms. So low intensity mind-body exercise might soothe certain levels of neurotransmitters and growth factors that affect stress, that affects psychological stress, right? Things such as high intensity might modulate different levels of neurotransmitters. So all intensities and all forms of exercise do different things. There's a lot of shared stuff that they do, a lot of similar mechanisms, but there's different neurochemical and neuroendocrine profiles that come from these different modalities. So if I said high intensity aerobic training is the best thing for your brain, you're potentially missing out on these other things. Mm-hmm. And so we have these different profiles from different exercise prescriptions. We have these different profiles that are people, that are individuals. How do we make them meet? That's where this prescription modification comes from. Is you have two unique, wildly complex mechanistic things. How can we make both meet in the middle to achieve your goals?
Gosh, this is so amazing, Ryan. I feel like we could talk to you forever. And I do want to just ask one last question that it could go on forever, and I hope it doesn't. But fibromyalgia, chronic pain, regional syndrome, all of these things, the goal, we want them exercising, we want them moving.
Yes.
But the problem is there's pain with movement. So are there studies in terms of what's happening within the brain with fibromyalgia and exercise prescriptions in which people could start to possibly look at?
Great question. That could go on forever.
I know. I knew it.
Let me answer that briefly. There's pain science considerations here. Mm-hmm. Sensitivity, neural signal modulation, things of that regard. I won't get into that piece. There are better experts in that realm. When it comes to these conditions, which I haven't studied in depth, we would know that there's probably some changes in cognition because of the pain. And so coaching can help facilitate this process, as potentially can modalities of exercise that maybe improve executive functions, right? I like that story of someone with shoulder pain and they can't lift their shoulder and they say, grab that can from the top, and mm-hmm. they grab it, right, with no pain. What is that example entail? External goal, reaching for something without paying attention to the internal signals. Maybe that's relevant for this, right? Yeah. So when we have a neuromotor exercise like dance or ping pong or something like that, they're not paying attention to maybe how they feel. They'll still have signals, right, that may distract them, right? But they're focusing on the instructor or the moves or something like that, and it's goal-oriented. So maybe, I say maybe because once again, I'm not an expert in the literature on this, but maybe goal-oriented behaviors through exercise can help facilitate that process. Versus I try to do something like a shoulder press, and I feel it, and I'm aware of it. And also modulating attention through things like mindfulness, because being distracted by a pain signal is selective attention, the ability to filter out irrelevant stimuli. Well, maybe that signal is so strong because of neuroplasticity that we pay attention to it. How can we temporarily filter out that signal through paying attention to other things or modulating the strength of that signal through things like mindfulness or movement? In addition, how can we incorporate things like mindful movement, yoga, tai chi, qigong, self-myofascial release, mobility exercises to facilitate that process? And then I would assume that there's inflammation occurring systemically and centrally in the brain because of these things. And my master's thesis was on neuroinflammation and exercise variables. So higher intensities of exercise might change how these inflammatory biomarkers react. And so I will just say that experiment with intensity, mm-hmm. experiment with the type of exercise, and experiment with the duration, the frequency. Because if we look at exercise as medicine, exercise as a poly pill, which it truly is, and if we consider the medication metaphor, there's a lot of ingredients. There's different dosages. There's different ways of looking at this pill that is exercise. So in any condition for that matter, whether I'm talking about cognitive health, you're talking about autoimmune and neurological conditions, we have to experiment with the dosage. And I think that's where we're coming from, is that we assume that these ingredients that are all important, but we have to mess with it. Yeah. It's like a recipe. And we can give as many metaphors as you will, but I think medication and diet are good metaphors that people can understand to give themselves and allow patience and maybe even curiosity about how these variables modify their neurological health, whether that's centralized central nervous system, brain, or that's peripheral nervous system, which is involved in the conditions you're talking about. And to modulate neurological health, we have to mess with these ingredients, if mm-hmm. you will.
Yeah, I think once we start talking about pain and chronic pain or fibromyalgia, I mean, like you said, so many considerations there.
Yes.
But just being able to do some things, like you said, like focusing on external goals, using our selective mindfulness to the greatest advantage that we have the ability to, and mm-hmm. continuing to train that during some of these activities could be a start, as well as, like you said, focusing on some of those systemic inflammatory things.
Right.
And I think that plays back into probably my second favorite thing I've heard you talking about this like idea of prescribing exercise and how we really need to approach it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a blog post when I was working through grad school called Exercise Prescriptionist. Physical therapists, I was writing specifically from the physical therapy, you know, approach, that we are the exercise prescriptionist. We know what this does physiologically in our body. And I love how you've chatted us through how we can do that for the brain, how you have a course to help us do that for the brain. Where can people find that course to dig in on this stuff more or find out a little bit more about you?
Yeah, so it's primarily for health and wellness professionals. So health coaches, physical therapists, occupational therapists, personal trainers, yoga instructors. We've had a variety of people take this course. It's called the Brain Health Trainer course. People can go to brainhealthtrainer.com either around the time this podcast comes out or sometime in mid-February. The American Council on Exercise, ACE, will be carrying the course, which I'm really excited about because
congratulations.
Thank you. And it's been a couple years in the making. And so I respect ACE because they have things like a behavior change specialist or a medical fitness specialist. And so to be alongside their different types of credentials is really exciting for me. And I really respect the level of education they have and allow fitness professionals to understand this stuff and niche it better, mm-hmm. if you will. And so they can go to brainhealthtrainer.com to check out the course. And if you've heard of ACE or you're on their email list, you may be hearing about it around mid or late February. You can go to ACE, AmericanCouncilOnExercise.org, or I think is the website. No, acefitness.org, perhaps. Just Google it. And hopefully it'll be there. And they can follow me on Instagram at glatt, G-L-A-T-T, as in my last name, .brainhealth. So glatt.brainhealth. That's pretty much it.
Yeah. This is amazing. Literally, we can go on so many different topics, and maybe we'll have to do that in the future.
Struggling to stop this right here.
I think the future awesome is stuff. Really exciting, where if you're a physical therapist, it's not just this mobility assessment, but perhaps there's even just a questionnaire on brain health they fill out, or whether it's about their age-related beliefs, which we know positive age-related
past
beliefs.
Traumas, behaviors, getting to know people for who they are in those areas.
Yeah, subjective
super
cognitive function, but I believe in a future which is, it's within grasp, it's here, it's just not standard practice, that people show up to an appointment, a physical therapy appointment, with all of the things, their x-rays and their mobility assessments and maybe some, you know, MRI, but also a brain MRI and cognitive testing and questionnaires about their belief systems around the body and the brain. Mm-hmm. And you have that to work with in addition. And that's the future I envision. Those tools are available now. We just have to normalize that.
Make it accessible.
It's amazing. Well, thank you. Thank you so, so much. I appreciate your knowledge. The fact that you didn't get into PT school is probably having people shaking, like, this guy is so smart. How am I going to then this is why I hate standardized tests too. You are so incredibly smart. Thank you so much for doing the work and continuing to dive in yourself so that we can learn selfishly through you, and like what you're providing people is just amazing. So we'll have all that linked up. You guys can check it out in the show notes, go to our website and follow Ryan so that you get all the knowledge and improve your brain.
And there we have it, yet another amazing guest on the Optimal Body Podcast. So now what we ask of you, if you loved any bit of that or resonated with it, go share it out, share it with a friend, share it on your social media, because you know there are more people out there that would resonate with it just the same. Also, subscribe, rate, review on your favorite podcast app so we know what you want to learn or other guests that you think we should bring on for you in the future. Keep tuning in to find your optimal body.